Welcome to Micro College. This is our first interview of 2024 and the 51st. So we're on to our second 50 here. For this episode, to kick off this year, really very, very honored and excited to have as our guest Philip Francis, who is the founder and director of the Seguinland Institute in Georgetown, Maine. One of the really premier gap year programs and participants in this micro college movement. Person that I've had a chance to visit and has visited here to Viroqua in the past year, and very much looking forward to this conversation. Philip, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me, Jacob. What a pleasure to be here. Huge fan of everything you guys are doing out at Thoreau College, and very happy to be in conversation with you.
Thank you. Before we dig into this, I just wanted to take this opportunity to say a couple of things. We are here early in 2024 still, coming to recording this in early March. If you're hearing this, is still a great time to check out some of the Thoreau College programs that are going to be happening, and also programs coming up at Seguinland and the other folks who have been featured on this podcast. Here in Wisconsin at Thoreau, we have a couple of farming and land-oriented programs coming up this spring. A 3-week program in April called Living on the Land, which will have a permaculture and regenerative agriculture design component and biodynamics, as well as homesteading skills. We also have the Thoreau College Field School in May and June, which is a bioregional immersion, including folk arts and crafts, and agriculture, farm visits, as well as foraging and nature ecological literacy here in the Upper Midwest. We also have a Shakespeare Festival and Shakespeare Intensive program coming up in June. 3-week program leading up to performances of Henry V and Romeo and Juliet out here on our campus, which Philip has seen here. And then very much we'd like to invite people to check out our fall gap semester, the Metamorphosis Gap Semester, for which we are accepting applications now. So just a little information there, encouraging people to check it out. And Philip, do you want to say anything about things that you've got in the works for the coming year?
Sure. Although your programming sounds so great, I want to come out and attend all of those, especially after having seen the Shakespeare Stadium that you guys have created in the field there. So beautiful, magical spot. We're recruiting for our Good Life May term program that's coming up here mid-May into June, and then we have our Good Life Gap Semester program in the fall and in the spring that we're now accepting applications for.
So I should mention that I've had the privilege last June of visiting the Seguinland campus, Georgetown, Maine, just a bit up the coast from Portland and Bath. One of the most beautiful places to do educational activities I've ever seen. There's tree houses, and it's a tidal estuary there, and it is really idyllic, beautiful place. And this is where Philip is from. Philip Francis is grew up on a boatyard there in Georgetown, Maine. He learned to philosophize in that salty mix of lobstermen pragmatists and back-to-the-lander idealists. After painting the bottom of many a boat, he took his questions on the road to liberation theology base camps in Nicaragua, ashrams in India, and monasteries in Greece. He settled down at Harvard Divinity School, where he completed his doctoral work in religion. He completed a postdoc at University of Pennsylvania and professorships at Carleton College and Manhattan College, before returning to his home state as associate professor of philosophy and religion at the University of Maine in Farmington. His book, When Art Disrupts Religion, was published by Oxford University Press in 2017. So thanks again for joining us, Philip.
Thank
And
you.
here on the podcast, we always start with people's biographies, and there's a little bit of a life story there, but I'd like you to take us a bit more specifically back to the time when you were, period, when you were 18 to 21 years old, about the time of the age period, which the students that we are working with, that phase of life, and where were you at that time, and how has that shaped what you've done since?
Thank you for the question, Jacob. Yeah, that period of years just looms so large for me, and I can't tell if it's because it truly was so formative or because I've ended up working with that age group, and so I'm always to some degree projecting myself back to those years and trying to tap into the things that I was feeling, the joys and the confusions and the excitement and the anxieties that were so much a part of those years. And so I dwell in the memory of those times so often. I mean, I think I was trying to sort out what so many of our students are trying to sort out. Just, you know, what of your upbringing are you going to carry forward into adulthood, into this next phase of life? And what are you going to leave behind? We always do this little exercise with our students here during just about every program. We, you know, hand them 30 little scraps of paper and we say, you know, almost in a stream of consciousness way, just try to write down 30 messages about life, ideas, insights, catchphrases that you feel like, for better or worse, you have internalized up to this point in your life. And don't put any judgment on them. These don't have to be things you agree with or things you disagree with. Just try to write them down, get 30 things down. And then we take them through this process of separating them into three piles. So in one pile, they put things that they're pretty sure at this phase of life that they want to carry forward into the next phase. And in another pile, it's the discard pile, things they're really quite sure they want to leave behind. And then the third pile, which is often a very steep pile, is things that they're really not sure about. Like, maybe this is something I should carry forward, but maybe it's something I need to leave behind. And so I think in those years, I was very much doing that exercise, but in a very, you know, kind of haphazard way. Yeah, I think some of the things I was grappling with from my upbringing were this, growing up on a homestead in Maine, this little family boatyard that had been inspired by Scott and Helen Nearing's book, Living the Good Life. My parents were back to the Landers who had moved up here to Maine in the early 70s and, you know, had tried to live out that ideal, this countercultural way of life. And I literally grew up seeing that book, Living the Good Life by Scott and Helen Nearing, which was such a Bible for the Back to the Landers of that era, just sitting on the coffee table. That was just, you know, that was always, always present. And it's actually right on my desk next to me right now, too. So I was sorting out, you know, what of that very particular form of upbringing I was going to carry forward into my adult life and what pieces of that I would leave behind. There was also a religious inheritance as well. My parents had had a religious conversion experience in my teenage years. And so I was sorting out, you know, what of that am I going to carry into this next life? And what am I going to leave behind? The other thing I think that characterized those years for me is I was having a lot of the educational experiences that were so formative and really lit the fire of my love for this form of whole person education, you know, kind of educational experience that just engages you body, mind, and soul. You feel like you are fully immersed in a transformative experience and you come out as a changed person and with your mind just on fire. So a few of those experiences in that time, just briefly, I'd gone to this very quirky alternative high school up here that emphasized experiential learning, influenced by John Dewey. And you know, the director, who I actually just learned passed away, was this really inspirational figure who just had, you know, this sense that we could do anything educationally on an absolute shoestring budget. So we'd been studying Mexican history and culture and Spanish, and he just had the idea. I think it felt like he had it maybe 2 months in advance of the trip. Let's get the whole high school. Let's jump in some 15 passenger vans. Let's drive down to Mexico City. My sister lives there. We'll do volunteer work out in these outskirts and some of the roughest parts of Mexico City. You'll all live with families. You'll study. And you know, 2 months later, we were doing it. And we're driving in these vans and sleeping in church basements and food pantries. And I can't, you know, I'd love to see what the budget was for that whole trip, but it just gave me this sense that, you know, a rich educational experience can be had on an absolute shoestring budget if there's just that kind of that visionary person to push it forward and to believe that we could do this thing. And so that made a huge impression on me and ignited a love of Latin America in particular. And in college, I was studying Latin American studies and did this program that was based, a semester study abroad program based in Costa Rica, Nicaragua, Guatemala. And again, another kind of visionary director figure who just had so assessed who we were as this cohort of mostly white North American students, middle class coming down to Latin America and just put us through this incredible program that turned our worldviews upside down and allowed us to meet people that just had completely different perspectives on life and well-being and economy and culture. And yeah, I'll never forget the time when like our final assignment for one of our courses there came in the form of an envelope, and you opened it up and there was like bus tickets in there to go from San Jose, Costa Rica to Managua, Nicaragua, and then take three more little buses out to this tiny village and then do sort of an ethnographic immersive study of this little town, which happened to be a Sandinista outpost where they had had some of their most successful literacy programs, and every person in this little village had a poetry book that they would write in just about every day. And of course had a, you know, a very, very different perspective on the world than what we were coming in with. So that just, again, showed me just how powerful an immersive educational experience could be. And then a third program, just again, very briefly here to throw into the mix. It's a program that I didn't attend, but actually had a huge influence on me. Called the Oregon Extension. And a number of friends of mine had gone out to this place and they came back with all these new ideas that challenged some of our philosophies of life and some of the religious frameworks that we were working within. And they were passing out the books that they had encountered there and talking about these rebel professors that had started this program in the 70s up in the mountains of Southern Oregon and created this experience that just leverage them out of their previous ways of thinking. And so between those three educational experiences, I think was already born in me this desire to maybe create something like that one day. So yeah, so that was my that's what was going on with me in those years in a nutshell.
Yeah, that. Thank you for sharing that story. I mean, there's so much in your background and really your approach to education that resonates very personally with me. I think that our backgrounds have a lot of similarities, so that's pretty fun. Including having the, you know, the Living the Good Life, Helen Scott Nearing's book on the table and on the shelf, same way. And with the difference that your family actually has a connection with the Nearings there, and that's you're from the neighborhood there where they ended up farming.
Yeah,
But
exactly.
similarly, you know. This, you know, the incredible privilege of these experimental, you know, like really rich educational experiences led by visionary people, has been so impactful in my life, and certainly inspiring to, you know, more people should have those experiences. That certainly is one of the ways
Yes.
that I articulate what the work that I'm doing, and I see that's something that you're bringing as
Absolutely.
well.
I feel the same way. Yeah, I feel like everything that I was given through those experiences, it just feels like the most natural thing to want to give that back. And everything that I was given by this particular place, Georgetown, Maine, by this land here, it, again, it just feels like the most natural thing for me to want to invite students to step into that and enjoy the benefits of that.
Yeah. So that's you know, one of the core principles of this movement that we're a part of, that we kind of fleshed out a bit actually at the convening that they're in at
Yeah.
Suburban Mall Summer, is its place-based aspect. And boy, do you have an incredible place. So maybe could you just flesh that out a little bit? Like what is your place like, and what does that bring into the education that you're offering to the students at Suguinland?
Yeah, sure. So we are very lucky to have this 60-acre campus here, 40 acres of which is the original family homestead where I grew up. And I think the program retains a little bit of that sense of being on a family homestead. And I think that also is kind of disarming to students coming in that are feeling a little jaded or displaced in the world. And then onto that, we were able to acquire an adjoining 20 acres. And we're on this tidal river, as you mentioned. We're on the Back River, which is a little spur off of the mighty Kennebec River, one of the most important rivers in Maine. And yeah, this we are. We consider place-based education to be, you know, just it's always essential, but I feel like all the more now, where there's just such a sense of displacement, where people don't have this deeper connection to any particular place or any piece of land. So I always think at one level, we're just modeling that very simple idea for our students that you can kind of commit to a place and commit to a piece of land to be a caretaker and a steward of that land. And then you step into this kind of reciprocal relationship with the land. Whereas you're taking care of that land, of course, all the more it is taking care of you. And so I think, I think our students get a little glimpse of that. And it's tricky. I know how in a program, we have students here for a semester in our longer programs, and how do you invite them to connect deeply to a particular piece of land in a relatively short period of time? So, we have a few things that we've started to build in, including foraging, which you've mentioned, that we want students to know the name of every tree and plant on the property. And we have a tradition of creating a foraged feast here. So it's one of the highlights of our programs, where students work with a couple different local foragers to learn and identify the plants, but particularly the edible plants, and then to create an entire feast out of the bounty that before they thought was just something, a plant, unnamed plant under feet. Students write an ode to that plant and read it aloud during the feast. And we go from one dish to the next. Anyways, I think it does help to create something of that sense of being place-based, of having a connection to the land. We always read Robin Wall Kimmerer's Braiding Sweetgrass book, and she talks about this concept of species loneliness, that we modern people experience this deep sense of loneliness, of course, for many reasons that we could talk about. But particularly, she thinks it's a loneliness derived from that just alienation from the land. And her remedy is that you need to learn the names of these plants, develop some kind of basic understanding and relationship to these plants and these trees that are all around you and sustaining you. And through developing that, even just the beginnings of that sense of a relationship with those non-human species, you begin to connect to the land, and some of that species loneliness starts to dissipate.
Yeah, that's so important. And definitely something that we do here. Something that I experienced just the couple of days that I spent on your campus there, that totally, totally different from something we have here, are the tides, right? Just this kind of powerful rhythm of the water, connected with the moon and the sun on a daily basis. That
huge.
Just can only imagine, like, living into that rhythm if you're not from that part of the world for the first time. It was really, even for a couple of days, was very powerful.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, students often comment on that too. They have to walk across this little bridge that connects the two pieces of land and goes across this little inlet. So that every hour of the day that they pass through there, the tide swings wildly, nine foot tidal swing here. So they experience the land differently. And it does, it creates some kind of rhythm. It's something they can't not notice that is going on all around them, but that is just built into this place.
Yeah, the only thing analogous here, I would say, really are the seasons themselves, which of course so much, a relatively longer time frame. But this is why I think it's important for us to have a whole semester. If people can go from August to December, they will have experienced some important natural cycle.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then you have to draw their attention to the moon and some of the other cycles that are happening. But the tides right there outside your door is really a powerful like heartbeat of the place.
Yeah, so. Yeah, it's huge. And I always think, I mean, our programs here, we have just such a simple mission from the very beginning. Yes, we wanted to create this immersive experience program, but the very simple concept of it was, we need to create a space where young people can step away from the confusions of everyday life to just think with some clarity and depth in a sustained way about these fundamental questions of the good life. So that phrase, the good life, that was on that little book of my parents, definitely imprinted itself on my brain. And as I, finished my own educational process and thought about what kind of teacher I wanted to be, that phrase kept bubbling up to the top. And then, pair that with looking out at our social landscape, where it just seemed like there were fewer and fewer places where young people could step away to get perspective and think deeply about that big question: how do I go about living the good life? It seemed like, the most important thing that we could do would be to create that space. And so then for us, it was really, we think of it as our job as to create the setting or the ethos in which people can think most deeply and with the greatest clarity about these questions of the good life. especially in a setting that's non-dogmatic, non-ideological, is always important to us from the very beginning that this not be a place that's pushing one version of the good life, or not pushing Scott and Helen Nearing's vision of the good life or my vision of the good life. Really, we just, as of course that stuff all influences us, but we aspire at least to be a place that is not pushing one version of the good life, but creating the setting in which deep thinking about the good life can happen. And so, coming back to your question about being place-based and the natural world, I mean, to me, and maybe this is a built-in assumption of the program, was that just that we do some of our best thinking about the good life when we are close to the natural world, not when we are so alienated from nature. So we wanted this to be a place where people could have that sense of being immersed in the natural world and begin to cultivate that relationship as a way to then think deeply about what counts as a good life. And the other idea we had too was, there's a lot of wilderness outdoor programs out there from Knowles, et cetera. And I love those programs. I think they're fantastic. But we were also seeing that there weren't as many programs that were about being an on-ramp for people who maybe weren't comfortable in the natural world at all, and probably and maybe would never do a Knowles or an Outward Bound type program. And so we always wanted to be a little bit of a starting place for people to connect to the natural world as a source of grounding and insight and contemplation. And so that's just been a fundamental pillar to our good life programs from the very beginning.
Yeah, I think I'd love if you're open to it. I think it's worthwhile to just say a little bit about Helen and Scott Nearing, just because I think their book and their example were so important to, sounds like, our parents and back to the land movement, which came so strongly out of the 60s, and certainly our community here in Viroqua, Wisconsin, and a lot of the food movement and the environmental movements that we've taken for granted in a way come out of that book. And they were from a different generation, right? And they're I really see them after having visited you and be reminded of that book. Went and read Living the Good Life again, and really they're picking up the task that Henry David Thoreau, also another New Englander, there is working on, is
Absolutely.
living deliberately, right? Thinking about what are the important, the essence of a good life, of a meaningful life, and concluding, an interesting division of time and engaging with nature and also with community and ideas also. Maybe can you just for, because many people I think in recent generations have not really engaged with this work and with these thoughts.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. So Scott and Helen Nearing, as I said, they were gurus of kind of multiple waves of back to the land movements here in the United States and abroad. Their influence also rippled out abroad for sure. But yeah, an interesting couple. Scott was he'd been a professor of political science, economics. He'd been blackballed because he was basically a Marxist communist. And Helen was from very cultured family, musician, performer. And anyways, partly because of the depression, partly because of Scott being blackballed, and partly because of their growing sense that the current culture was just corrupt and that we needed to break away and start again, a fresh new way of being American, a fresh new way of being human beings. And so they dropped out of culture and went to Vermont and formed this homestead, and they homesteaded there for 20 years. I guess basically from the 30s into the 50s, and wrote a couple books about the experience, including, I think, what was their second book called Living the Good Life, subtitle, How to Live Sanely and Simply in a Troubled World. And I believe that came out in 1954 the first time, and then was re-released in 1970, because there was, again, this growing movement of people that felt discontent with the way that American culture, society, economy, politics was headed. This was obviously the hippie movements of the 60s, the counterculture there, and a number of people from that generation came across this book, and it just started being passed around, and it really inspired, you know, tens of thousands of people in that generation to do what my parents did, which was ditch the city and go country and try to live this sustainable, simple, sane life in a moment where it seemed like those things were so hard to come by in the mainstream world. So Scott and Helen, their journey took them from Vermont, then they started a brand new homestead up here in Maine, actually, where they spent the remainder of their years. I think Scott died at the age of 100, and Helen was right around there too. But my parents, so just being as a case in point, they were in New York City, and my dad was a graduate student in psychology at Columbia when the hippies took over the campus there and occupied the administration buildings. He still says, you know, he was a graduate student, so he was just observing the everything that was going on there. But I have a feeling he might have been in one of those offices occupying as well. Anyways, they too felt like the culture was corrupt, and they had heard about the Nearings, read the book, came up here, sort of did a pilgrimage to the Nearings homestead, stayed with them for a weekend, I believe. And I remember my dad always said that, you know, you showed up at the Nearings, they say, oh, welcome. Well, let's talk out in the garden, working side by side. Like, they would put you to work right away. And that was a huge part of the Nearings overall ethic, was this serious work ethic. And it's clear that that is what it takes to sustain any kind of, you know, small economy, small homestead such as this. So, but Nearings made an impression. My parents bought land up here, and the rest is history. So growing up here in Georgetown, Maine, it was an interesting mix. As I said, as Jacob alluded to in my bio there, that there was a, you know, a dozen or more in this tiny little town of, you know, 700 people. There were several dozen homesteaders who had come up here having read the Nearings, living and working side by side with, you know, third, fourth, fifth generation lobstermen and clammers and fishermen. And it was an incredible mix of people to grow up in. Many of the backs of lanterns were kind of overeducated carpenters and boat builders and farmers like my folks. And to see them mixing with people who really had deep connections to this land and the ways of this place, made for, you know, just a great stew of ideas and ways of living to grow up in. So yeah, that's the Helen and Scott Nearing story in a nutshell.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. I think it's an important story. And as with Thoreau, I think also the Nearings, if you read what they wrote, I mean, it's not necessarily that you know, the specifics of everything that they advocate, some of which are kind of quirky, right? Build everything out of stone, right? They're strict vegetarians, mm-hmm. and, you know, the yep. way they organize their day. But I think it is just that invitation that to consider how you are living your life and you know, yeah. and live, don't accept what has come, you know, from the past and or by habit, but live deliberately. And I think that's something that I enjoy bringing to the students who come here. And I see that you're just this prompt: what is the good life and how do we live it? Is a great one to start an educational venture with.
Yeah, that right? It's not obvious. And yeah, as I think, right, our program is, as I said, there's no teaching. There's not like one book that is the Bible for our program here, by no means. But something of that instinct that Scott and Helen Nearing had, that to really observe and critique a society and do something constructive requires some element of stepping away. Some instinct for retreat can underwrite a clearer vision of what needs to change in society. And I think that had a huge, huge influence on our program here. One of the early ideas I had was, you know, we all know that there's retreat centers that you can go to and sort of bliss out, but you're left with nothing to chew on after you return to everyday life. And we also know there are plenty of academic institutions where it's idea heavy, but these places very often, far too often, are just riddled with anxiety and competition and some of the worst elements for thinking deeply about questions of the good life. So we always thought, you know, could we combine a place, create a place that combined this sense of a retreat with academic depth of ideas, where you could, you know, get some of the clarity that can only come by stepping away from mainstream culture for a time and think deeply about some of these ideas, be challenged by texts and conversations so that you can think more clearly, develop some wisdom to see more clearly what needs to change in your own life and in the larger society. So that was very much the Nearing's perspective as well. And they're such a case in point, right? I mean, they dropped out of mainstream society so completely and yet ended up having this huge influence that we just talked about. And somehow that's a rare perspective these days. I see in young people who want to change the world, they don't think that the first step is getting some clarity by stepping away from the mess that's out there. So I think I've always been influenced by that idea of retreat or pilgrimage, and that we try to create a sense of that for our students here.
Yeah. So that's a great segue to your actual programs there. The flagship, kind of the main thing is the Good Life Gap semester here. Yeah. Good Life Gap Year. You've also done some shorter programs. I know that the Good Life program has been primarily a fall semester program, but you'll be adding a spring semester as well coming up. So maybe you could just talk about those programs, how many people are, how many students are there, and what is a day or a week or kind of the trajectory of the program look like?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we've landed on a 21 person cohort as being the ideal size for us. It still feels humanly scaled, to use your term, Jacob, which I absolutely love. And we just feel that that most people's educational experience is not humanly scaled. And for us, 21 is a great number because we can get to know every student very well. Each of them gets to know each other very well. And the kind of depth of mentorship, I don't know, that feels like an old school word, but yeah, that mentorship or that ability to give good advice to a person that can come when you've really gotten to know them and been authentic with them and related to them as, you know, as the adults that they are becoming. So that humanly scaled 21 person cohort is just perfect for us. So our fall semester program, we structure it around a progression of three courses is one way to think about it. So students do get college credit while they're here. We have this affiliation with the University of Maine, where I used to teach. And so students taking courses here are actually getting their college credit at the University of Maine. And yeah, they move through this progression of three courses. The first course is the philosophy course. That's with me. We just call it the Good Life course. And that's the one where they're just asking, we're creating the space for them to ask these big, timeless questions of the good life. And to me, there's just no more universal question than how do I go about living the good life? You can't think of any more universal question than that from my experience. So to orient them towards that, and that first course is really designed to press them to think about life as a whole. William James, the philosopher, another New Englander, the great founder of pragmatism, or one of the founders of pragmatism, is a huge influence on me personally. And I'm sure that trickles out into the program in a number of ways, but particularly around this idea in his book called The Varieties of Religious Experience, where he's, you know, studying the wide variety of religious expressions that human beings have given birth to over the millennia. But one of the things he comes back to that is common to these reasons, they press you to think about life as a whole, not just one piece of your life, but the whole thing at once. And he thinks that this is a very, you know, unique human capacity that for a lot of us just goes completely unutilized. And, you know, it's that state of mind where you're not thinking about one piece of your life, like you're professional life or your romantic life or whatever it is, but you're trying to step back and think, hold the whole of life in your mind. And James seems to suggest that the great insight of all these religious traditions is that we human beings need spaces in which we can think about life as a whole. And when you do, some part of you kind of comes alive, kickstarts, that at some point in your life, you need to flip that switch and think about life as a whole, rather than just, you know, one piece of life or just that sort of unending progression of individual moments of a life lived. And when you do that, there's a new relationship to yourself, a new relationship to your community, and a new relationship to your sense of what counts as a good life starts to come into focus. So anyways, that's a long way of saying that's the goal of that first course, is just to try to hold them in that space. So, you know, so the first course is engaging some of these timeless themes of joy, hope, silence, solitude, awe and wonder, you know, these gratitude, reciprocity, something, you know, these, just that, again, if you're going back to William James, right, as realist, these are just the themes that any great tradition that is worth being passed one generation to the next must engage across all cultures and all time. So anyway, we try to hold them in that space, in the first course. And then the second course, we call it the good life for all. And if that first course is really about the timeless and universal question, the second course is really supposed to ground them in the contemporary moment and you know, create the space for them to think deeply about what are the pressing issues of our time and how we approach those things in a holistic manner, not just a reactive way, not with just one part of our being and not for just one, you know, protest in the streets, but over the long haul, how to engage with these pressing issues of our time. And I would say questions of climate and climate resilience are just fundamental to that course. But even there, we, you know, hopefully these courses build on one another. So the things we've talked about, whether it's hope and joy, or silence and solitude, carry through to that second course too. And so we think about, you know, how do you become a long distance runner working for a holistic approach to, say, building climate resilience in local communities? Well, what's the role of hope and joy in that? What's the role of silence and solitude, of stepping away and getting perspective on how to run through things? So hopefully those courses build on one another. And then the third course is called the Creative Life Course, and that's for art credit, taught by our wonderful creative director, Marcia Dunn. And the way she approaches that course is, yes, it's for art credit, but it's not looking at one medium or another, but really it's an exploration of creativity itself. How do you tap into your creative instincts? How do you expand your capacity for creative thought and action? And that course is the kind of culmination of the whole program, which I hope indicates just how central we consider the arts to be in any kind of meaningful education that's aspiring to engage the whole person. But also just, you know, we're living in such a rapidly changing world. And it seems like in that context, you have to be creative. It's really, it's not an option here. We have to adapt and change so rapidly, or get creative in the ways that we relate to that change. And so we always want our students to come out of here, you know, more equipped with some skills, some experience in tapping into their, what I think are just these inherent creative instincts that we all possess. So the course is not just for artists, but for all of us. And yeah, it's interesting. Marcia often does this exercise with them on the first day of the course. She just calls it, you know, mapping their history, their relationship to creativity. And for so many, I would say 3/4 of the students, probably, in the story they tell is, I thought I was really creative up until age 9 or something, or 8. And then somebody told me I couldn't draw good. And that just ended it. I'm not an artist. I'm not a creative person. And I just went off on some other track and left that whole part of myself just dormant there. It's a kind of heartbreaking in a way when you hear that story repeat again and again and again, and you think about how that magnifies out over a whole culture of people growing up, 3/4 of which don't think that they are creative or even have that capacity to be creative. So the Creative Life course is just an awesome culmination to the progression of these three courses.
Yeah, beautiful. It's a very like well thought out and detailed structure, which I really appreciate. Really is.
Yeah, I wish I could say we sort of preconceived it beforehand and like thoughtfully, but it really evolved through, you know, trial and error and figuring out what works and like, oh, moving things around. But it does feel like now it feels like it's achieved that kind of a really, really good flow for students.
Yeah. And how long have you been doing the program?
We did our first semester program in fall of 2020, but we did our very first program in 2015. We launched initially doing month-long May-term programs when I was at Manhattan College in New York City, and I'd bring a crew of Manhattan students up here, and you know, they'd have fun in the woods and think about big ideas, and it was a total blast. So we did that from 2015 to 2020 when we launched the full semester program, which had always been the vision.
Yeah.
So we've been running like that ever since, doing the continuing with our May term program, but then adding these semester programs now fall and spring, as well as a January term wintering writing workshop.
Yeah. Yeah. It's one of the reasons it's a very exciting moment to be in communication with you and the other, you know, our peers in this little movement, is that I think we were all, you know, there's an amazing kind of an emergent phenomena quality to this. Yeah. Many of us were starting around the same time, 2015, 2016, and then kind
Truly.
Of opening around 2019, 2020. And now we're in relationship in the last year or so, you know, meeting in person. Yes. Was just out at a gathering in Deep Springs with several of the folks who were also there at Seguinland. And, you know, the podcast here, and just, it does have a great sense of momentum that we're learning from each other and
absolutely,
hopefully more people are hearing about what we're doing.
I feel like just being in conversation with these others, and maybe particularly you, has given me some of the vocabulary to just describe what we're doing, and to realize that there's this more national need for this kind of programming that I just have always instinctively loved, but haven't and fully appreciated how rare that is as an experience for others, and how much we need it.
Yeah. So one thing that Helen and Scott Nearing talk a lot about in their book is the structure of the day, right? Yeah. And I wonder if you could just give a very like nuts and bolts picture of that. What if you're one of those 21 students there during the Good Life Gap Year program, what is the day like, and what are the rhythms and major milestones there?
Sure. Yeah, Helen Scott Nearing had an interesting thing that we don't follow it exactly, but I've always been intrigued. Different philosophers and literary figures, from Tolstoy to the Nearings, have tried to do this. Like, what makes up the ideal day? If you had to break it down to, you know, how much time should you dedicate your hours to this, to that, the other? Of course, there's some privilege of this. Most humans and for most history have not had much choice in the matter. But the Nearings, in their model, the idea was that you spend 4 hours of your day on bread labor, 4 hours of the day on your avocations, like music, writing, this thing that brings you joy, inspiration, creativity. And then you spend 4 hours on social and civic engagement, interaction, whatever. So that was kind of their little formula for these things. And so I think you can kind of hear all the elements of that in our program. We don't do as much with labor as you guys do out there at Thoreau, though I'd love to integrate more of that in.
You do some though, right? And you're growing some food and
Yep, totally. We're growing some food here. We still have the old family gardens and this little greenhouse, and we interact with a lot of local farms as well. So students do a number of days volunteering at local farms and getting their hands in the soil and engaging their body in that way is certainly part of the program. So yeah, in a way we try to think that each day at least contains some of each of those three elements that the Nearings describe. So, I mean, I can kind of give you the flow of a day here just to paint the picture. So students live in these little cottages along the river, and they wake up, and then, you know, they're supposed to do a little walk in the natural world in solitude, though often they cluster together and out there. So they do a little nature walk, which then ends with them going across that bridge that I described and up to our treehouse gathering space. and which is this wonderful classroom up in the trees, again, designed by our creative director, Marcia Dunn. And the idea there was to really blend the sense of being indoors and outdoors. And it's built in the trees, and trees come up through the building, big window. So you just,
it's really cool.
Right. You've been in the space. Yeah. So students start there. They meet there with our mindfulness instructor, Ida, who leads them through about an hour of mindfulness practices. And the mindfulness piece has become a bigger and bigger part of our program. Early on, it was just a small little element. But you know, I think especially seeing what this next generation has been through, coming through COVID, you just get this sense that their minds are pretty scrambled up right now, and they're overwhelmed, and their attention span has just been diced up for so many reasons, because of a lot of the chaos of the world and the uncertainty, but also, of course, the forms of technology that they're engaging just have that immediate, obvious effect of just fracturing one's attention span. And so out of that observation, and then just, you know, the larger philosophical observation that, though not even philosophical, just seems obvious that whatever you dedicate your attention to is what will constitute your life ultimately. And I just feel like we are so casual with our attention these days, and just don't protect it in the ways that we should. We allow ourselves to just get pulled this way and that way with every little bell and whistle. I remember a line in Living the Good Life, or one of the Nearings books, where Scott talks about why he doesn't have a telephone. And it was basically like, he's like, I'm not against the technology itself, but like, I just don't want to be in a place where someone can just ring a bell and I have to jump to attention immediately and go scurrying across the room just because anybody wanted to ring my bell. And yeah. So
that never happens anymore, actually.
Yeah, exactly. What an old fashioned idea. So I'm sure that was students, and there's, you know, all around the room, they're just, you know, nodding. It's just all beeps and blips and buzzes. Not, again, not that you have to be anti-technology. We're certainly not here, but this idea of guarding your attention seems so important. And so the mindfulness practice is really key. And, you know, there's a range of practices that Ida teaches. We know that, you know, very few students are going to be comfortable with the form of mindfulness that's just like, you know, sitting cross-legged and following their breath or something. So it's, you know, she teaches a range of things, from meditative nature walks, and it is amazing to see how far a student can travel along that path just in a few weeks here. You know, you see the difference of the anxiety levels come down, their ability to just focus on our conversations. I mean, I should document it more carefully at some point, but I often feel like, you know, the first couple of days their minds are just pinging around with ideas, and then after a week you can really see like they can hold an idea and go deeper with it. Part of that's just the setting, and, you know, the low anxiety setting that we're trying to create here, and part of it's being immersed in the natural world, but I think also part of it is the mindfulness practice that they engage in. So anyways, an hour of mindfulness. After that, the professor of the day walks in and introduces the theme of the day. We try to build each day around a theme that sort of knits together all of the various experiences, all the ways that their body, mind, and soul are being engaged. So, you know, if that's me, and if it's the Good Life course, maybe I'm introducing the theme of awe and wonder. And maybe I do a little mini lecture on awe and wonder to set the terms and get the conversation up to a certain level. Hand out a little reading on the theme of awe and wonder. We love this little essay by David James Duncan, a Pacific Northwest writer that I learned about through the Oregon Extension, that program that I talked about. And he has a beautiful essay called Yogi Wonder Gladly. And it's a beautiful reflection on the importance of being intentional about cultivating and making opportunity for these experiences of awe and wonder. And so anyways, professor might introduce that theme of awe and wonder, mini lecture, hand out some readings. Maybe there's a journal assignment, send them off into the woods with their journals to reflect on the readings and the lecture. Come back, we're circling up into a big group conversation, breaking down into small groups, whatever. Break for lunch. And then usually the afternoon is when we do what you might call more directly experiential part of the program. So if the theme is awe and wonder, maybe that's a day where we're headed down to Reed State Park and walking on the miles of beaches there at the ocean front. So they're having some experience of awe and wonder, or we're getting in the boats and going out to Seguin Island, which is 2 miles out into the Atlantic, and is where it's the island that is our namesake. So we always try to make a trip out there. But again, standing on the cliff sides and just staring out at the expanse of the Atlantic and letting the power and the majesty and just transform your consciousness in that moment, transform your relationship to yourself. And David James Duncan has a great line at the end of that essay where he says something like, "When you're grasped by awe and wonder, you are grasped by awe and wonder alone. Fear, judgmentalism, rationalism, anxiety cannot penetrate when you are grasped by awe and wonder." And so I've just always felt like that's an important theme to have in there. Anyways, so that's the experiential part of the day. And then, we're back in the boats, back home to campus. And students usually have a couple hours off in the afternoon. And then we gather in our cookhouse. We have a cookhouse where all the meals are prepped and served. And we eat dinner around one long family style table. And I always feel like a lot of the bonding among the group happens there around food. And students are on, part of the work element is students are on different crews. So one night you're on dinner crew helping prep dinner. Next night you're on dish crew, you're doing the cleanup. And the night after that, you're on what's called vibe crew, where you're creating the vibe for the dinner, you're making the playlist or the theme or some little conversation that you're gonna start during the dinner. So food's become more and more an important part of the program here, and try to eat, good local food and give them an experience of what it is to be really well nourished and delightful in the way you approach food. So yeah, that's kind of the flow of the day, loosely related to that nearing structure, and where you're just trying to engage all parts of their being throughout the day.
It's beautiful. Yeah, I think one thing that stands out from your description there is that, you've mentioned Marsha a couple times, which mentioned that she's your wife
Yes.
and co-founder in this project, which is, I think it's a picture of being all in, committed, and you've got young children who I met here
Yes.
who visit here in Wisconsin.
Yes.
I guess that I'm wondering if you what is that like to integrate your own personal life so deeply into this group of 21 young adults?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. We talk about it a lot, as you can imagine. I'm sure you and your spouse do as well, because it's not just Marcia and I, but also Ida, who I mentioned, who's the mindfulness instructor, is also a sister-in-law, and another sister-in-law is in charge of the food component of the program. So there's a lot of family togetherness here, and I'm sure similar to you, it's we feel so lucky to be able to work together and to have this so integrated with our lives. On the other hand, of course, you need to be so intentional about finding points of separation between our work and our personal lives. So, I mean, it happens sort of fundamentally just because there's these breaks between programs. And so it's, when a program is on, I mean, we are just, it's our whole life. And over the years, we've always thought, oh, there's got to be some way of drawing those boundaries during a program, and we've kind of given up on that, to be honest. And and students know when you are full in with them. If you want to run an immersive program, you yourself have to be fully immersed. I just don't think there is any other way, and it's probably why so few people get into this line of work and are able to sustain it over the years, because it is really demanding of us, body, mind, and soul. But I think the payoff is huge too, and I would never complain about it. It's a joy to be so engaged in the educational process, and to be so, connected to our students in this way, and to be able to work with family on this land where I grew up. So yeah, I feel
There's a
so
tradition there, the Nearings, and just family farming and other
right.
family businesses like boat building and things like that, which
Totally.
is something that is lost for many people, in our modern world. There's a separation of the home and the workplace, and
Big time.
it certainly is challenging, but also I think it is something unique that we can offer to our students, right? A
Yes.
picture of family life, interactions with young children and with in this
Absolutely.
kind of context is something that I think is meaningful and something that people are seeking out along with the relationship to nature and to the land and to peers. It is also, you know, kind of whole communities, including whole families.
So
Certainly something
true.
that I think of as something we're bringing to our students.
Yeah, no, my kids and lots of families always kicking around during the program. And so, yeah, I've had a number of students say over the years, wow, it just must be so cool, your kids growing up and they actually get to see what you do for work. Like they're there. And, that same student will say, my parents, they left at 7:30 in the morning and they just walked into some black box that I never ever once got to see inside of. And then they come home at 7:30 at night. And yeah, what a difference that is from what my kids are seeing and what I saw growing up, growing up right there on the homestead. The folks lived and worked there. We lived right next to the boatyard, right next to the gardens. And so, yeah, there's a little tradition there for sure.
So that something that's woven throughout everything that you've been saying, and your professional career, you went to divinity school, you wrote a book about art and religion, and it's interesting to hear about the increasing role of mindfulness in the curriculum that you're building there. Maybe you could expand a bit more about how do you think about spirituality, about religion, about these kind of inner development practices within the kind of work that you're doing, and also what is the relationship that you see of the students as they come into your programs from all their many different backgrounds to that? And what do they, how does that change while they're there?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I think about it all the time. I mean, I think I got into studying religion myself, partly because I was grappling with some of that family background in religion and wanted a place to sort those things out. In another way, I think I was just always wired to be thinking about these big kind of meaning of life questions. And then as I got further into academia, I just realized that the study of religion is, in some ways, the most interdisciplinary field that you can engage in. And most of the other academic disciplines were born out of the study of religion, whether that's arguably philosophy, sociology, anthropology, and so I just loved being able to transgress all of those boundaries and study from any disciplinary perspective that I wanted to. And so I hope that also infuses our programs that, yeah, even when you're taking a philosophy course, if you're taking an English course, or they're taking an art course here, that's really, yes, there's some important disciplinary themes that you have to engage, but that you can really engage any of the questions of the day, the themes of the day from multiple perspectives. So I love that about the study of religion. I think, yeah, studying and reflecting on religion all these years has also just sort of forced me to think about where we are at in the modern world, this time when there has been a significant decline in religious participation, at least participation in traditional religious institutions in some parts of the world, particularly in Europe and increasingly in the United States. So I guess I've been thinking a lot about what has been lost and what has been gained in a civilization that is stepping away from religion or kind of radically rewriting their relationship to religion. And so I'm always trying to read that in myself, first of all, and people close to me, but also in our students. How are they making sense of that sphere of religion or spirituality? And is there some meaningful way that we can translate some of the ideas that have been passed on through various religious traditions into a modern vernacular that can be meaningful and be a way for these young people to create a sense of meaning and enchantment with the world? Some of the great sociologists of religion have often described the decline of religion in the West as a kind of disenchantment that sort of spilled from the Enlightenment up to the present time, where we just sort of, it's often phrased as we gained an ability to see the world more clearly by following the scientific method, which has allowed us to do so many, incredible things. So it's never a question of being anti-science, but at the same time, it seems we've lost the ability to see reality as having, a sort of multi-layered quality to it, of having an enchanted quality, of having these deeper structures of meaning and purpose. And so I think at the very least, I want our students to engage with that as a question, to not just see it as obvious that we are stepping into a realm where we all want to be rational, and thus that's, you know, we don't want to be religious. Rather, I think it's, yeah, engaging these questions of meaning and purpose, often by drawing on some of those traditions that are quickly fading away. That being said, I mean, we are, you know, it's really important to us that we are not identified as a religious institution, that we want, you know, to be an inclusive place where people of any background, religious, non-religious, anti-religious, can find a place to think about this, these questions of the good life, because the question of the good life doesn't presuppose any religion, any spirituality. So that's one level of it. I do find myself, you know, finding that most of our cohorts are pretty secular, so to speak. And so I find myself, you know, as the teacher, you don't want them to just, yeah, come in one way and leave exactly the same way. So, you know, you're assessing your students and thinking, how can I challenge, how can I enrich their view? And, you know, given that most of them are coming in, you know, thinking that religion is just a sort of silly relic of the past, I find myself actually more and more probably trying to stir up those questions in them and think, has it all been a net positive, our stepping away from religion? What about that sense of community? What about these meaningful rituals? What about the power of symbols and myths and stories? And you know, where do you find those these days? What's your source of those if you're someone who's not going to identify with religion? I find myself always putting it in quotes because it's such a vague, it's a term that's so loaded for right. So many reasons. So I almost hesitate to use it. And in classes, I'll almost not use it because it does come with so many presuppositions. And I'd rather not fight that fight. I'd rather get to the conversations about meaning and purpose that is actually, you know, drawing from maybe religious traditions and non-religious traditions and stirring things up in that way. So that's it. And then I guess the William James thing that I mentioned earlier too, that these religious sites used to sort of press you to think about life as a whole. And I certainly want our students to be doing that. I also mentioned awe and wonder. You know, I think there is some way in which we have to, I don't know, at least grapple with the fact that we are these small, fragile, vulnerable beings, and that we are sort of held in the hands of much greater forces than ourselves, whether you think about that in purely biological terms or whatever, that there's some kind of reckoning with that relationship to greater powers, higher powers, whatever. It doesn't have to be God, but coming to terms with that, I think I find myself pressing my students to at least spend some time thinking about that. We still read Annie Dillard's Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, and I always think that opening chapter is such a powerful expression of that, where she talks about this image of, I believe it was some Inuit children that would play this sort of throat music where they would blow into each other's mouths to play the vocal cords of the other. And it was this kind of musical, very intimate musical tradition. And anyways, she uses that image to talk about this sense that we are, that something, it's not just us as these autonomous actors in the world, which is such the prevailing notion of the self in the modern West, but we are also being played upon by these greater forces, that something is playing music through us. Yes, we all want to be these, you know, masters of our own destiny, and we want to be practice Emersonian self-reliance, but there's also this sense of giving over to the fact that we are part of a story that is also being told, that we ourselves are being written as characters as much as we are striving to write ourselves. And I don't know, I mean, I go back and forth on this, but I do think, probably at the end of the day, personally, I do think there's something crucial about entering into that and naming that and accepting that, that opens up some vistas of the good life. But I never want to be too dogmatic about these things. I just feel like, given my own life and, you know, the twists and turns and, you know, the various philosophies and religious lines of thinking that I've moved through, I feel humbled by the, you know, the smallness of my mind compared to the vastness of all things. And I find myself often quoting to myself and to my students the line from John Locke, that all of our combined knowledge is but a grain of sand resting on the edge of an abyss of ignorance. And I feel like I live with that idea very clearly. So I always, you know, I find myself, you know, I have some of this fervor to proclaim the things I've learned in the classroom, but I also feel just very, very chastened by that fact of having been wrong so many times and having revised things so many times. I want to bring that to our students as well. That sense of epistemological humility, basically. Yeah.
Absolutely. Wow, that was really powerful and beautiful. Thank you for sharing that perspective. I do think it's a really important part of what we all are doing. We express it here in our kind of core, description of what we're doing as being meaning centered. But really, I think that above all is opening the space that you're talking about for these sort of questions or just intuitions to emerge. I think, I think places that are explicitly religious today also can exclude the opportunity to have these sort of experiences. And it's telling that Emerson, you mentioned Emerson just a moment ago, I think he, models, earlier on in a different phase of American history, basically stepping out of the church, out of formal religion, actually allows for re-enchantment in our modern time in a way, right?
Absolutely.
So I certainly see our students, coming with often a very vague, but a real like sense that they're looking for that experience or just people to talk about, intuitions with. And certainly that's one of the ways I understand what we're doing here. And that's, it's sort of a negative image description of a curriculum, what you're not doing, you're opening up some empty space for these sort of things to flow in.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. The question of mystery, I think, is a big one. Yeah. Embracing the mystery, again, that's some of that contemporary vernacular we're trying to grapple with or articulate as a way of getting at these ancient religious, spiritual, philosophical ideas. Yeah. Embracing the mystery, accepting the reality of the uncertainty that characterizes all life, and not relating to those things as something that has to be fearful or terrifying or be that existential angst that characterizes life to some degree, but doesn't have to be the whole story. If I was going to say like one more religious term that I find myself, or religious concept that I find that I wish I could sort of empower my students to embrace, it's that concept of grace. Think about the Wendell Berry poem there, the Peace of Wild Things, which we always, before students arrive, we always send them this little package in the mail called the Good Life Package, and it's books and readings and poems. And it always includes Wendell Berry's little poem, Peace of Wild Things, which many, many people know. But that final line about, he's anxious, he's waking in the middle of the night and worried about, the future and the future of his children. And he goes and lies down where the wood drake is. And he says, for a time, I'm there and I rest beneath the day-blind stars. I rest in the grace of the world and am free. And I just so wish that for my students, that they would have that sense of rest that some of us experience at least some of the time. And, and many great philosophers and religious people have borne witness to at least experiencing that sense of being, again, held by something that's not malicious, something greater than yourself, that's not malicious and that will, that can hold you and that you can rest within, and that it's not merited, it's not earned, it's not something you you can lose either. You could forget about it, you can deny it, but that you can't lose. And I do feel like that is a fundamental existential state that we can tap into sometimes at least. And I find myself, as I see our students more and more, and everything they've been through with COVID, and all the bumps and bruises that are upon them coming out of that, and just the larger social turmoil that we've talked about. I just find myself, that's sort of my wish for them to rest in the grace of the world and feel that freedom of being in that space, that unearned, unmerited kind of favor that some people have described as a sense of grace,
Yeah.
mercy. Yeah.
I think that's a beautiful place to end, Philip. I really want to thank you for your work. Thank you for spending some time with us, and thank you for your colleagueship in this movement. And yeah, good luck with all of your endeavors, and stay in touch.
Thank you, Jacob. My pleasure. Appreciate the conversation and look forward to the ongoing conversation. And thank you for everything you do with this podcast and for fighting the good fight out there at Thoreau College. Grateful for you.
Thank you.